Thank you, Ursula. All righty. On a Wednesday, and I'm running on about 4 hours of sleep. So it's not going to be a good show. Tell you right now, low bar. Low bar. We ask you, the listeners, to please tell us what song you'd like to have Tom come in from. By the way, rumors still floating around the town may be here on Friday. We'll find out. But right now, here's Sean from Arlington with Sitting on My Cow.
Sitting on My Sofa, sorry. It's also by the Kinks. Sean is the one that recommended the song.
I love Jacob. It's also by
what did I
Sean
say?
And the Kinks.
I already told you that I'm running on 3 hours of sleep, 4 hours of sleep. Hey, Tom!
You know, I'm going to miss, once I get back in the studio, I'm going to miss all these great numbers introducing me.
Yeah. Well, we're doing that just sort of mix things up and also to try to get you come back in here again. Here's your normal walk-in music. Hang on. Here. This is your stuff. See, it's very Pavlovian. Yeah. There you go.
So, John.
Yes, Tom.
I'm sympathetic to you only getting 4 hours of sleep, but I think that Dave, Ursula, Colleen, they were also, at the show last night.
Yes.
And especially Dave and Colleen, they got even less sleep than you.
I operate at a higher level of creativity and need more sleep. We don't have anything written down, Tom.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Right on your own. All righty. I got one sentence here. Traffic in Seattle 2018. Fewer cars, bicyclists,
Yay.
And walkers. More transit riders and carpools. Fewer cars, so fewer people driving. Fewer people riding bikes, although we're spending millions and millions and millions and millions and not finished, and millions of dollars on bike lanes. And fewer walkers as well. But there's more people getting on transit and carpooling. There you go.
Yeah, so it's kind of a mixed bag. This is the City Transportation Department's annual report, and there's some interesting things about it. It is pretty significant that even though we have 9,000 more people in this city than we did a year ago, that the number of cars have actually decreased by almost 2%. So that is some progress. It's not enough progress, as everyone says, but that is some progress in terms of kind of relieving congestion. And I think the other good, the positives out of this is that, yeah, transit ridership is up to 25% of all commutes, which means a quarter of us are commuting by transit. I don't know what the original percent was, but we have 7 million more people getting on King County Metro and 4 million on Sound Transit.
More?
And carpooling.
More yes. or
more boardings.
Yes, more boardings. Okay.
Yes, more boardings. And then carpooling is up. So that's the good stuff. The thing is, if we have fewer people walking and fewer people riding bikes, that is not what the city envisioned. Mm-hmm. And as a result, John, I know you don't think that Seattle city government is very responsive.
It isn't.
But because the Department of Transportation says they are scaling back the 50 miles of protected bike lanes and 60 miles of bike infrastructure to about half of those miles because it's not catching on. So there has been some response along
those
lines.
Well, they do that all the time. They make a promise that they're going to have six stops and six trains, and then they reduce it down to four, or they make a promise the thing is going to be delivered on time or delivered to an area, and then they cut it back.
Well,
here's my question, Tom. Let's just to point out the pure inefficiency of government. So we ordered four trains, and we find out the trains are too big or too small to fit on the tracks. Who got fired? Because in a business world, if you had put the order in and you had spent the money and the purchase had gone through and the money had cleared and then we find out the trains are too big, in the business world where you are driven by the bottom line of profitability, you would lose your job. And the chance of you getting another job would be slim to none. So it's like a cancer. The great thing about the private sector is it takes a metastasized cancer. And in most cases, because that organism needs to run on profit fuel, it takes the cancer of the incompetent and removes it so that the rest of the business can work effectively. Unlike government, when you order four trains that don't fit, or you decide you're going to be able to spend billions of dollars on something and then never deliver on time or never deliver on budget, you don't lose your job. So that cancer, the metastasized incompetent individual, continues to cause problems in the system. And that's why the public transportation system and the money that they spend on bike lanes is wasted. I talk to a guy who rides his bike in every day. You know what? He doesn't ride the bike lanes. You know why, Tom?
because they're not done.
Nope, nope, nope.
There's no
nope,
connectivity.
Nope. You want to hear from a guy that rides bike lanes?
Bike lane projects.
Nope, 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 no. You want to hear why?
I hear from this guy, sure.
Yeah, here we go. Because he doesn't like to have to stop. So he rides in the car lane because he says, if I do bike lane, I have to keep stopping at all of these stops. I got to sit there and wait for the cars to go left. So I just get right in there and I ride just like I normally ride, which is right beside the car, right behind the right bumper. And that's what I do. He says, those bike lanes, you are constantly stopping and waiting and getting hit by the light. He says, I just roll right along with everybody else. So they put the things in, right? And it's for safety and things like that. But you're not improving it because it's too wet, too cold, too hilly, and you'll never change that. But we spend billions of dollars because the bike Nazis that run part of Seattle City Council continually slam away, and they don't like you in your car, and they'd rather have you in a bike, even though less and less people. So here's the thing. I realize they're cutting down on the expansion of the bike thing. Will at some point, will they stop the road diet crap and allow more cars to be on the road to move through Nickerson and other places like that? Or do we continue to squeeze down the lanes? And then what do you know? People get out of their cars because it's less efficient. And we then have an empty lane with no bikes in it. Okay, I'm done.
Well, John, I mean, this road diet business, it's anticipating the fact that we're going to have hundreds of thousands of more people in town. We can't all be in our cars, and because of that, we need to figure out ways to get people around without their cars.
So, wait, the road diet philosophy is probably not going to change. But how by squeezing down the number of lanes, how does that improve efficiency?
Well, the idea is because it's going to force us to develop transit availability so that all the people that do work downtown, say, can get around without their cars.
Oh, okay.
Well, so you're going to need the lanes for light rail or for more buses and the like. And the idea is that in order to get that many people around, nobody in New York City, you've got all sorts of, you got the subway system. Imagine all those people in the subway system in cars. It would be unmanageable. That's what they're anticipating.
So they closed Nickerson down, and the Federal Transportation Association says you need to be able to move. If you can move 20,000 cars at a certain period of time, it's okay to have a road diet, so you can squeeze it down at 20,000. But what happens is, whenever you build anything when it comes to public transportation, you're always 5, 10, 15, 20 years out looking at growth. Well, they say within a number of years, we're going to have 23,000 people on that road diet on Nickerson, and at that point, it's inefficient. But they don't care, because what they really want you to do is make it as inconvenient as possible for you to be in your car. Why don't they put metal strips, spike strips down every quarter mile so it flattens your tires? It would be more of an incentive to get out of your car, because every time you drive a quarter of a mile, your car tires get flattened. That would force more people onto the buses. This is just a slow death of the person in the car, because they'd rather have you driving in a riding in a bus or riding on a bicycle. It is obvious what they're doing, John, and I guess they pride themselves on the fact that more people are carpooling. Yeah, because it's absolutely impossible to get around the city.
But the problem is it's not. 51% of the commuters to the city, you know, still drive their cars alone.
Right.
So
right.
Clearly, we're not making it impossible for people. You've got most of the people on the road are driving, and they are driving alone.
But they're driving
the idea
right,
here
but
is
Tom,
that we're
they're,
not.
They're on. It's longer commute to get out of here. But here's this. Just give me this. If no one's using the lane, if we decide, you know what, it was a mistake to put the bike lane in, it's a waste of space, it's a waste of money, you have to get down to the metrics. What do you want to spend, and then how much do you want people to benefit from it? Like, do we spend X amount of dollars to move X amount of people? Is that a good use of the taxpayers' money?
Yes. And because they're making adjustments, I suspect they may feel like the bike infrastructure is more expensive or too expensive to justify the cost. However, and I'm not a bicyclist. I think it's too dangerous to ride a bike in Seattle. I don't care how many bike lanes they have now. It's still too dangerous. The bike advocates say, and they're cited in the Seattle Times article as well, say that the reason we don't have more bicyclists is because we do not have any kind of finished lanes. What good is it to drive down a protected bike lane for five blocks and then you have nothing and then maybe a mile later you pick up another mile's worth. If we had an entire system, it would work much more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's safer. The more cyclists in the road, the safer the bicycling is. That we've had, we're starting to see some numbers dip in terms of fatalities and serious injuries. And if we could encourage more of that, it might happen. That's definitely the case in Europe. And I know we're not Europe, but we're transitioning there.
That's what they want. That's why they like trains rather than buses. You're a big believer. You're like that train that takes people from Seattle to the airport.
Yes, that's efficient and fantastic. I've taken it many number of times.
It's slower than buses, and it drops you off a quarter of a mile away from the terminal where the bus used to drop you off right at the thing. They predicted 105,000 people would take the thing daily. 29,000 people take it. It costs more. It's less efficient. It's not as fast, and it's further from the terminal than the bus. But because we like Europe and we think trains are sexier than buses because we love Europe, we love to have little trains.
It's certainly faster, John, and because it's not in traffic, it just zips you to the airport.
Uh-huh.
It's faster and it's more comfortable than I don't know what you're comparing it to. Being riding a bus there, it's so much easier to get on that thing, and then it goes right by. I mean, it's really great what it is. Now the problem is you have to get downtown first. For instance, when I do that, mm-hmm. I have to take my luggage on the bus with me to get downtown. But once I get to the light rail link, you just zip to the airport. So
and
it's
then,
definitely
and then you walk the quarter
faster.
Mile. Then you walk the quarter mile to the terminal.
You know what they say, the quarter mile, it's all covered. You know, we walk quarter miles in airports all the time to get from one gate to another. Quarter mile is not that far. It's all covered.
Right.
So it makes it sound like you're a quarter mile out on the highway, dragging your, that's not true. It just feels like you're just part of the airport. Right. You walk into the airport and you end up walking, probably a quarter of a mile.
Right. Where the bus used to drop you off right there, didn't it?
Well, sort of. The bus went past the idea. So you don't, but a quarter of a mile compared to once you're inside the airport, it just feels like you're going to the airport. It doesn't feel that that long. And depending on where your gate was compared to where the bus stop was, it's not that much different.
Hey, by the way, just breaking news, ex-Trump attorney Michael Cohen is sentenced to, is that 3 years in prison?
That's correct, yeah.
3 years. He gets 3 years.
Ah, okay.
There you go. Don't lie, Michael Cohen. All right, let's see. Pelosi and Trump, don't characterize the strength that I bring, she says. Huh? Oh, this is the back and forth yesterday. What? This was the silliest thing. I watched the whole thing in its entirety.
Uh-huh.
Because I love live theater. I don't know why they did it. I still don't know whose decision it was. Was it just
it was
just Trump's. But did Trump decide he wanted to debate it in front of everybody? Because at one point, Schumer, who looked kind of embarrassed, two of the weirdest looking postures there, one was Schumer and one was Mike Pence. I mean, Mike Pence was like, what am I doing here? And Schumer looked like, I just want to get the hell out of here. I guess it was the president decided that he wanted to publicly talk about it, right?
Yes. Well, so both Pelosi and Schumer wanted it to be private. And he says, no. He says, it's all about transparency. Let's do this in front of everybody. And most of the reviews have come in and they sort of say that the Democrats and especially Nancy Pelosi got the better of the president, even though this is the president's arena. They said the president turned this into reality TV. He thought he'd have the upper hand.
Yeah.
But he ended up, and again, this is from Republicans, too. This is not just a partisan thing. Republicans are afraid that Trump, in effect, gave away his strategy and gave away the farm by saying, okay, that's fine. I'm okay with a shutdown. I'll own the shutdown because Trump and Pelosi started out with calling it a Trump shutdown. Uh-huh. I'll own the shutdown. People will rally to my cause if I shut it down for border security. And at that point, Schumer said, that's fine. Fine. That's great. We're good with that. And leave it be. They did say that there was a note in one of the stories last night that he was really peeved after that. I think he did feel like they might have gotten the better of him, that when he walked in inside to wherever office, he flicked like a file of papers that went flying on a desk nearby. So I guess he was ticked off at the whole exchange.
Most people don't really care when the threat of the government shutdown. They think it's a bad idea. It just looks like government's not functioning correctly. 72% of people, Americans in 2013, reject the idea of a shutdown. And those numbers stay about the same. But what they find out is that, you know what, their life pretty much goes on as expected when the government shuts down. Sure, they can't get into particular places. I remember Obama really wanted to make it hurt people. So he shut down memorials and he put up velvet ropes. You couldn't get past things. Just to sort of highlight the fact that, look at this. This is what happens when the government isn't there. But after a while, people wake up the next day and realize, oh, you know what? The government shut down. As long as they continue to cut Social Security checks, welfare checks, and things like that, I can kind of go ahead and let those guys have their arguments in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it's bad optics because in D.C., especially over the holidays, because the idea is it could shut down as of December 21st. Over the holidays, people, you know, come and they visit and see the White House and the museums and that kind of stuff, that it's noticeable. One of the odd quirks is they say that his Secret Service staff could be trimmed. He spends 2 weeks, the president spends 2 weeks down at Mar-a-Lago, the Secret Service people will not be getting paychecks. They figured they'll probably stay with them. They just won't be getting paychecks at Christmas time.
Many of them do it for free. By the way, I don't want to start this because then we'll never finish it. The story from the New York Times says why we start things and never finish it. Within 9:22, if we start it now, we'll never finish it.
That's exactly right.
So we'll just get to this real fast. Would you rent a bed for an hour? Napping pods starting targeting exhausted workers and students. Yesterday, we did the live radio broadcast that Felix Bonnell wrote. We did it at First Presbyterian. At one point, we were sitting backstage, and Nick Allard was showing off, and he picked out a set of keys that he had in his right hand, and he held the one little key, little golden key, up in the air. I said, "What's that?" He goes, "Ah, this is the key that the maintenance worker gave me at Cairo Television to a secret closet that I have a wrestling mat in and a blanket, and I curl up and sleep in there for 20 minutes a day. No one knows about it. Now they will." And I have this.
Thanks, John.
Sorry, halfway through the story, I realized, But anyway, what a great guy. And he's got a secret closet. I wish, and by the way, Colleen O'Brien, especially on a day like this, where she's so tired and so is Dave Ross, that we're lobbying heavily here at Bonneville to be able to get one of these pods. Could a private company come into Seattle and start offering you? Would you go into a pod? Would you pay a couple of bucks to sleep in a little pod for a little while, Tom?
Absolutely. I think that is crucial. I get it on campuses and airports. Yeah, in workplaces like newsrooms where you tend to work 20, you know, on a weird schedule. Absolutely. Although I thought it was a little pricey. It's $10 to $12 an hour. That seems a little higher than I expected. But yeah, if you're really tired, it's probably worth it.
$10 to $12 for an hour? You'd be laying
That's
in there realizing, oh crap, I'm not asleep yet. I've already blown $5.
The pods are now available for use at the rate of $10 to $12 per hour.
They should have them at airports. I would do them at airports. I took a nap in one of those nursing ones. Man, is that comfortable?
What do you mean nursing one?
That place you go when you're nursing? No, in the hot in the at the airport they have big things
the airport.
For moms that are nursing.
Oh my God! Did all the moms complain?
No, because there's not that many waiting out in line. The same way I use the family bathroom. The family bathroom is so much better than the other bathroom. Why? Not as stinky.
You can change your diaper without disturbance.
Right back. Laura's Home Loans. Laura Keel, 833-ASK-LAURA. 833-ASK-LAURA. Laura's Home Loans. All right, Tom. It was right after the shooting there in Parkland, Florida, the Parkland High School, that Dick's, the president of Dick's Sporting Goods store, he made a big announcement. This is back in February. He announced that he would stop selling guns in the wake of the shooting. I think he said he would stop selling AR-15 type weapons, and then also rifles would not be sold to anyone under the age of
under 21.
Under 21. Here he is.
He bought a shotgun from us back in November, and it wasn't the gun, nor it was the type of gun that he used in the shooting. But when that happened, we realized that the system, and we did everything by the book. We did everything that the law required, and still he was able to buy a gun.
Amazing that he was able to buy one.
He was still able to buy a gun.
So they did everything that the law requires, and still he bought the gun. So the problem wasn't that there's not stringent laws. It seems to be the person who got the gun.
When we looked at that, we said...
No, or more stringent laws.
Or yeah, even more stringent, right. I don't know what those would be, but without encroaching upon the Second Amendment.
The systems that are in place across the board just aren't effective enough to keep us from selling someone a gun like that. And so we've decided that we're not going to sell the assault-type rifles any longer.
Okay. This kid obviously had all sorts of mental issues, right? People knew about it. The FBI knew about it. The police knew about it. Everybody knew about it. But yet he was able, he went in, got a gun, and went in and killed all those kids. During the interview on Good Morning America, the president and CEO says he is prepared for the backlash.
We know that this isn't going to make everyone happy, but when we take a look at what those kids and the parents and the heroes in the school, what they did, and our view was if the kids can be brave enough to organize like this, we can be brave enough to take these out of here.
Okay, so they take the guns out, and of course there's a bunch of people that get upset about it, and then news broke that the CEO of Dick's had hired three lobbyists to go to Washington, D.C. to lobby on behalf of gun control, so then a bunch of manufacturers of guns said, you know, we make these guns, we're not even going to sell them to you anymore, Dick's Sporting Goods store. So now the story that comes out today, basically taking a look at how much did this hurt Dick's and how much did it help Dick's in order for them to be so public and to make this, you know, sort of big political announcement that they're going to do what they can to control guns.
Yeah, there are many angles to this story. One is they were talking about the significance of Dick's Sporting Goods as opposed to smaller outfits like REI, they mentioned. Mm-hmm. And they say that a place like REI, there were like something like 200 REI customers who wrote a petition to REI to say that they wanted them to discontinue using a particular product because they profited from selling ammunition and the like. And they say, so for REI to come out and take a gun control, a pro-gun control or gun reform stance is not surprising, and it's good for business because it sort of fits their clientele.
Sure.
But a place like Dick's, which is by far the largest in the country with 47 states, they're sort of like that Bud Light commercial. They're for the many, not the few.
Right.
How does it play? Because everybody across America has access to a Dick's Sporting Goods store, unlike REI's. And they say that what's interesting about it is that sales now did diminish. It became a media firestorm. Fox News and Breitbart used all of their, efforts they could to kind of, badmouth Dick's or make sure that this was high in the energy level. And so when they do surveys, you have very many Republicans saying, yeah, you know, we don't like what they did. Mm-hmm. They said right now, though, the problem is they haven't been able to officially gauge how much the impact on Dick's Sporting Goods, because he says most gun sales are done in the fall, and he says it's still too soon to see how the shakeup is. Mm-hmm. They have suffered, Dick's Sporting Goods has suffered, but they say so has the entire gun industry, thanks, ironically enough, we've pointed this out a number of times, thanks to the election of President Trump, there is no longer that panic buying that was very strong for 8 years during the Obama administration. So the entire gun industry is down, so it's hard to gauge exactly what how Dick's is being hurt by the media firestorm, right, since the entire gun industry is also down.
Well, I looked that number up, and I found 2016, the 4 million additional guns were sold compared to 2015. And then 2017, the last number I saw, that it's going to be almost equal to, if not surpassing, 2016. The additional sort of push now, I think, with you hit Nancy Pelosi and the 30 folks that got zero ratings from the NRA have been elected and are in the House, you'll probably start to see gun purchases go back up again, even maybe even higher than 16 and 17. Oh, but the other thing is that when Sports Authority closed, all the money that rolled into Dick's, because now that became the big guy in town, and everybody started to shop at Dick's. The stock went up to $56 a share. It's back down around $34 a share. Overall, they might even have to close their Field and Stream stores because in order to be more efficient with their dollars. And they're closing the Field and Stream stores as a way of consolidating Dick's to be able to control their revenue and their expense side because they've lost money. And politically, the question is, you'll never be able to prove it with metrics. Does how many people are now not shopping at Dick's and how many people are shopping at Dick's because they don't sell these guns?
Well, yeah, and they said that a lot of Democrats and independents expressed support, obviously, for Stack's decision, the CEO's decision, who, by the way, interestingly enough, is a Republican, is actually considered running for office as a Republican in the past. Mm-hmm. But they say that, and so they say a number of people have started to shop more at Dick's Sporting Goods as a way of solidarity with his stance, but they say, but it's outnumbered by the people that are angered, yeah. With his decision. And they say, and it's usually the case, just in terms of politics alone, the aggrieved tend to be more apt to vote than the people that are, happy about something because they're happy about something and don't feel, the need to change as much. This article also calls into question the, I don't know if it's altruism or not, but the political stance, how seriously is this CEO standing by his position? Because he's not exactly an activist. They say that after they made this big push and announcement, He says, then they've kind of gone silent. And it's like they say a lot of times Target has done this too. A corporation comes out with a really strong statement to kind of capture the moment at the time, the push at the time. But then they get real quiet and they figure, well, people kind of forget if they were opposed to it and let it go on. They said if he really wanted to, stick by his message, maybe he should keep promulgating it. And he's clearly not.
Right.
And then they also point out, and it is true, he did hire lobbyists, two or three lobbyists. They've spent a grand total of $10,000 on gun reform lobbying, but compared to something like $200,000 on lobbyists for tax reform or something. So they say his priorities are not really such. And at the end, they suggest that maybe that Dick's was actually seriously, this could have all along been an economic issue. Maybe they decided they didn't like the ups and downs of the gun industry sales or gun sales, and so they were just going to get out of it. This gives them a high moral ground stake to get out of it when they might have wanted to do it all along. They say there are all sorts of possibilities for why he did what he did. Some of them noble, some of them just strictly economic.
Well, let's go back to that in February when the news broke. So what people want to find out, who is this guy? Where did he get his guns? How did he buy them legally? All the same stuff. And you find out in most cases, these people that obviously have great mental illness, that they buy their guns. Most of them buy their guns legally. And so then you say, well, then who sold him the gun? So somebody's at fault. Let's find somebody at fault here. So they said, hey, he bought his gun at Dick's. So then Dick's now is like, oh, my God, what are we going to say? How do we respond to this sort of stuff? So they call some PR or consulting firm, and they say, hey, if you really want to get ahead of this, because we've licked our finger and held it up in the air, and we watch MSNBC, and we can tell you right now that what you need to do, hey, this would be great. Ed Stack, do this. Say that you're no longer going to sell those AR-looking guns, the scary guns. You're going to not sell scary guns anymore, and you're going to have to be 21 to buy the gun. Because that kid was not 21. This would be great for you. Do it, because it's really, really going to help you. And we're going to get out ahead, because it seemed like there's this, remember all the stuff we saw in February, Tom? Just wave upon wave. It was nothing else but guns and gun control, and everybody was all up in arms. I think they overreached on this, and they took the advice, and now they're taking it in the shorts when it comes to profits.
Yeah, well, maybe, or maybe not. I mean, I think the article is much more kind of on the fence about why, whether it hurt or it helped. We'll find out. But ultimately, if that was just PR advice, he may regret the PR advice, or he might have, had a stroke of conscience and decided this is a bad look for us. After all, he does point out, to be fair to Dick's, the shooter bought a gun at Dick's, but that was not the gun that he used to mow these people down.
But that's enough for people to go in there and start screaming and yelling that Dick should do something. All right, because it's mostly symbolism. We'll come right back. We'll talk about the how Uber. What do you mean, no?
No, I mean, I think it's legislation. I don't think people were up in arms about Dick's Sporting Goods when the shooting happened. It was more about why we couldn't stop a guy who had so clearly had mental issues. Even the cops who delivered, investigated them, they couldn't lock him up. It's legislation. It was what the Parkland kids were after, not Dick's.
The Parkland kids were after a whole bunch of stuff. Take a quick break. Come right back. Ready. Again, working on about 4 hours of sleep after the big show yesterday. 600 people showed up at First Presbyterian Church. I'm on Harvard Avenue there in order to enjoy a live radio broadcast of an original play. It was a parody of the Hallmark Christmas movie. And Chris Sullivan got the biggest laugh. We'll get to that in just a little bit. And it was great to see everybody. It's always interesting because when I go to that thing, there normally, and Tom goes, there's the division between Tom's fans and my fans. And you could see the Tom fans that were sort of all milling in the corner, you know, not wanting to come over and talk to me. But then my fans came over and talked to me. And my point is always that your fans won't talk to me or even look at me. But my fans go over and talk to you and talk to me.
Oh, that's not true.
Oh, ho, ho, ho.
John, that can't possibly be the case.
I saw it yesterday.
Yesterday wasn't even there yesterday.
It doesn't matter. They were there. They were there giving me the stink eye. Uber has Uber Eats. It's a great convenient. I don't use it, but a lot of friends do that live in the city, and they simply press the thing. Uber then comes by, delivers the thing within a certain amount of time. It's great. So then they say, hey, I'll tell you what. What they realize, Uber says, if our driver can get everything in one restaurant, then therefore, and pick up all those orders in one restaurant, it saves him and saves Uber, and therefore it's more efficient. So they say to the person on Uber Eats that's going, hey, you want to get a pizza? There's a pizza discount at this restaurant. Are you okay with this one as opposed to that one? And if the person clicks on it, yes, then what happens, Tom?
Well, you get a discount.
Yes.
At least if this thing works right. So to me, this seems too complicated to work. But Uber is, you know, the master of this, so it must be. The idea is that if they can convince you, let's say you go on to Uber Eats to order something.
Yes.
And you see that Uber points out, there are two people in your neighborhood that just ordered something from Yanni's Greek restaurant. Mm-hmm. If you want to also get something from Yanni's Greek restaurant, we can give you a 20% discount. And if they can get enough of those in a short enough time, then, you know, they'll be able to cash in. And how will they be able to afford the discounts? Well, if Yanni's Greek restaurant gets so many orders because of the Uber Eats, then Yanni's may say, hey, guess what? We'll give you, you know, we'll lower our prices for you. It's sort of like ad revenue to mm-hmm. Uber. We'll give you credit for bringing in customers for us. That's the way it works. It just seems so tricky because the key is you have to be able to get enough people fast enough that you can cook all their meals, you know, in a short enough time that the person they had the first order doesn't get cold by the time they finish the third or fourth order.
But there's a cautionary note in the article basically saying, look out, Uber's going to play one restaurant off another restaurant in order to be able to have the ads appear on their Uber Eats app. And
yes.
You'll see, just like with Amazon, causes this sort of cannibalism between vendors. They said this will start happening with restaurants. One restaurant continues to drop its price in order to be able to get the mm-hmm. people so that Uber can just simply say, hey, we'll pick up all 10 orders at your restaurant. Eventually, what happens is the customer is always served by the price reflecting the person's desire to value the service that comes to them. So I love yes. it. I love it. Listen, if I lived in like a big city like New York City and it's like going out and Uber's able to deliver the thing in like 20 minutes, that's the way to roll.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, I figured out why your people come over to see me and my people don't go over to see you.
Yeah.
Because they know as a good liberal, I'm much more welcoming, so I wouldn't turn them away, whereas my guys might be turned away by you.
Right, because they're closed-minded. They think all conservatives are evil. We'll be right back.
No, just you.